That has to be straightened out.
An error like that should never have happened to begin with, Wesley said, peering around the room over the top of his glasses, the way he did when he was in a humorless mood. With us this morning is Detective Grigg of Sussex and Special Agent Farinelli. He looked at Lucy. She's the technical analyst for HRT, manages the Criminal Artificial Intelligence Network, all of us know as CAIN, and is here to help us with a computer situation. My niece didn't look up as she hit more keys, her face intense. Ring had her in his sights, staring as if he wanted to eat her flesh.
"What computer situation?"
he asked, as his eyes continued to devour her.
"We'll get to that," Wesley said, and briskly moved on.
"Let me summarize, then we'll move on to specifics. The victimology in this most recent landfill case is so different from the previous four, or nine if we include Ireland, as for me to conclude that we are dealing with a different killer. Dr. Scarpetta is going to review her medical findings, which I think will make it abundantly clear that this M.O. is profoundly atypical." He went on, and we spent until midday going over my reports, diagrams, and photographs. I was asked many questions, mostly by Grigg, who wanted very much to understand every facet and nuance of the serial dismemberments so he could better discern that the one in his jurisdiction was unlike the rest.
"What's the difference between someone cutting through joints and cutting through the bones?" he asked me.
"Cutting through joints is more difficult," I said. "It requires knowledge of anatomy, perhaps some previous experience."
"Like if someone was a butcher or maybe worked in a meatpacking plant?"
"Yes," I replied.
"Well, I guess that sure would fit with a meat saw," he added.
"Yes, which is very different from an autopsy saw."
"Exactly how?"
It was Ring who spoke. "A meat saw is a handsaw designed to cut meat, gristle, bone," I went on, looking around at everyone. "Usually about 14 inches long with a very thin blade. 10 chisel-type teeth per inch. It's push action, requiring some degree of strength on the part of the user. The autopsy saw, in contrast, won't cut through tissue, which must first be reflected back with something like a knife." "Which was what was used in this case," Wesley said to me. "There are cuts to bone that fit the class characteristics of a knife. An autopsy saw," I went on to explain, "was designed to work only on hard surfaces by using a reciprocating action that is basically push-pull, going in only a little bit at a time. I know everyone here is familiar with it, but I've got photos." Opening an envelope, I pulled out 8x10s of the saw marks the killer had left on the bone ends I had carried to Memphis. I slid one to each person. "As you can see," I went on, "the saw pattern here is multidirectional with a high polish."
"Now let me get this straight," said Grigg. "This is the exact same saw you use in the morgue."
"No, not exactly the same," I said. "I generally use a larger sectioning blade than was used here."
"But this is from a medical sort of saw."
He held up the photograph. "Correct."
"Where would your average person get something like that?"
"Doctor's office, hospital, morgue, medical supply company," I replied. "Any number of places. The sale of them isn't restricted."
So he could have ordered it without being in the medical profession.
Easily, I said. Ring said, or he could have stolen it. He could have decided to do something different this time to throw us off. Lucy was looking at him, and I had seen the expression in her eyes before. She thought Ring was a fool. If we're dealing with the same killer, she said, then why is he suddenly sending files through the Internet when he's never done that before either?
Good point, Frankel nodded. What files? Ring said to her.
We're getting to that. Wesley restored order. We've got an M.O. that's different. We've got a tool that's different.
We suspect she has a head injury, I said, sliding autopsy diagrams and the email photos around the table, because of blood in her airway. This may or may not be different from the other cases, since we don't know their causes of death. However, radiologic and anthropologic findings indicate that this victim is profoundly older than the others. We also recovered fibers, indicating she was covered in something consistent with a drop cloth when she was dismembered. Again, inconsistent with the other cases. I explained in more detail about the fibers and paint, all the while vividly aware of Ring watching my niece and taking notes.
So she was probably cut up in someone's workshop or garage, Grig said.
I don't know, I answered. As you've seen from the photo sent to me through email, we can only know that she's in a room with putty-colored walls and a table.
Let me again point out that Keith Pleasance has an area behind his house that he uses for a workshop,
Ring reminded us.
It has a big workbench in it, and the walls are unpainted wood.
He looked at me.
Which could pass for putty-colored. Seems like it would be awfully hard to get rid of all the blood,
Grig dubiously mused.
A drop cloth with a rubber backing might explain the absence of blood,
Ring said.
That's the whole point, so nothing leaks through.
Everyone looked at me to see what I would say. It would have been very unusual not to get things bloody in a case like this, I replied, especially since she still had a blood pressure when she was decapitated. If nothing else, I would expect blood in wood grain, in cracks of the table.
We could try some chemical testing for that.
Ring was a forensic scientist now.
Like luminol. Any blood at all, it's going to react to it and glow in the dark.
The problem with luminol is it's destructive, I replied. And we're going to want to do DNA to see if we can get a match. So we certainly don't want to ruin what little blood we might find.
It's not like we've got probable cause to go in Pleasant's workshop and start any kind of testing anyway.
Griggs' stare across the table at Ring was confrontational.
I think we do.
He stared back at him.
Not unless they change the rules on me.
Grig spoke slowly. Wesley was watching all this, evaluating everyone and every word the way he always did. He had his opinion, and more than likely it was right. But he remained silent as the arguing went on.
I thought,
Lucy tried to speak,
a very viable possibility is that this is a copycat,
Ring said.
Oh, I think it is, said Grig. I just don't buy your theory about Pleasance.
Let me finish.
Lucy's penetrating gaze scanned the faces of the men.
I thought I would give you a briefing on how the two files were sent via America Online to Dr. Scarpetta's email address.
It always sounded odd when she called me by my professional name.
I know I'm curious.
Ring had his chin propped on a hand now, studying her.
First, you would need a scanner, she went on. That's not hard. Something with color capabilities and decent resolution. As low as 72 dots per inch. But this looks like higher resolution to me. Maybe 300 DPI. We could be talking about something as simple as a handheld scanner for $399 to a 35mm slide scanner that can run into the thousands.
And what kind of computer would you hook this up to? Ring said.
I was getting to that.
Lucy was tired of being interrupted by him.
System requirements. Minimum of 8 megs RAM, a color monitor, software like PhotoTouch or ScanMan, a modem. Could be a Macintosh, a Performa 6116 CD, or even something older. The point is, scanning files into your computer and sending them through the Internet is very accessible to your average person, which is why telecommunications crimes are keeping us so busy these days.
Like that big child pornography pedophile case you all just cracked, Grig said.
Yes. Photos sent as files through the World Wide Web, where children can talk to strangers again, she said. What's interesting in the situation at hand is scanning black and white is no big deal. But when you move into color, that's getting sophisticated. Also, the edges and borders in the photo sent to Dr. Scarpetta are relatively sharp, not much background noise.
Sounds to me like this is someone who knew what he was doing, Grig said.
Yes, she agreed. But not necessarily a computer analyst or graphic artist. Not at all.
These days, if you've got access to the equipment and a few instruction books, anyone can do it, said Frankel, who also worked in computers.
All right. The photos were scanned into the system, I said to Lucy. Then what? What is the path that led them to me?
First, you upload the file, which in this case is a graphic or GIF file, she replied. Generally, to send this successfully, you have to determine the number of data bits, stop bits, the parity setting, whatever the appropriate configuration is. That's where it's not user-friendly. But AOL does all that for you. So, in this case, sending the files was simple. You upload, and off they go. She looked at me.
And this was done over the telephone, basically, Wesley said.
Right.
What about tracing that?
Squad 19's already on it.
Lucy referred to the FBI unit that investigated illegal uses of the Internet.
I'm not sure what the crime would be in this case, Wesley pointed out. Obscenity, if the photos are fakes, and unfortunately that isn't illegal.
The photographs aren't fake, I said.
Hard to prove.
He held my gaze.
What if they're not fake? Ring asked.
Then they're evidence, Wesley said, adding after a pause. A violation of Title 18, Section 876. Mailing threatening communications.
Threats toward who?
Ring asked. Wesley's eyes were still on me, clearly toward the recipient.
There's been no blatant threat, I reminded him.
All we want is enough for a warrant.
We got to find the person first,
Ring said, stretching and yawning in his chair like a cat.
We're watching for him to log on again, Lucy replied. It's being monitored around the clock.
She continued hitting keys on her laptop, checking the constant flow of messages.
But if you imagine a global telephone system with some 40 million users and no directory, no operators, no directory assistants, that's what you've got with the Internet. There's no list of membership, nor does AOL have one, unless you voluntarily choose to fill out a profile. In this case, all we have is the bogus name Dead Doc.
How did he know where to send Dr. Scarpetta's mail?
Grig looked at me. I explained and then asked Lucy, "This is all done by charge card?" She nodded. "That much we've traced. An American Express card in the name of Ken L. Purley. A retired high school teacher. Norfolk, 70. Lives alone."
"Do we have any idea how someone might have gotten access to his card?"
Wesley asked. "It doesn't appear Purley uses his credit cards much. Last time was in a Norfolk restaurant, a Red Lobster. This was on October 2nd, when he and his son went out to dinner. The bill was $27.30, including the tip, which he put on Amex. Neither he nor the son remembers anything unusual that night. But when it was time to pay the bill, the credit card was left on the table in plain view for quite a long interval because the restaurant was very busy. At some point, while the card was out, Purley went to the men's room and the son stepped outside to smoke."
"Christ, that was intelligent. Did someone from the wait staff notice anyone coming over to the table?"
Wesley said to Lucy. "Like I said, it was busy. We're running down every charge made that night to get a list of customers. Problem's going to be the people who paid cash."
"And I suppose it's too soon for the AOL charges to have come up on Purley's American Express," he said.
"Right. According to AOL, the account was just opened recently. A week after the dinner at the Red Lobster, to be exact. Purley's being very cooperative with us," Lucy added. "And AOL is leaving the account open without charge in the event the perpetrator wants to send something else." Wesley nodded.
"Though we can't assume it, we should consider that the killer, at least in the Atlantic landfill case, may have been in Norfolk as recently as a month ago."
"This case is definitely sounding local." I made that point again.
"Possible any of the bodies could have been refrigerated?"
Ring asked.
"Not this one,"
Wesley was quick to answer.
"Absolutely not. This guy couldn't stand looking at his victim. He had to cover her up, cut through the cloth, and my guess is didn't go very far away to dispose of her."
"Shades of the telltale heart," Ring said.
Lucy was reading something on her laptop screen, quietly hitting keys, her face tense. "We just got something from Squad 19, she said, continuing to scroll down. "Dead Doc logged on 56 minutes ago." She looked up at us. "He sent email to the president." The electronic mail was sent directly to the White House, which was no great feat since the address was public and readily available to any user of the Internet. Once again, the message was oddly in lowercase and used spaces for punctuation, and it read, "Apologize. If not, I will start on France." "There are a number of implications," Wesley was saying to me as gunshots from the range upstairs thudded like a distant, muffled war going on. "All of them make me nervous about you." He stopped at the water fountain.
"I don't think this has anything to do with me," I said. "This has to do with the President of the United States."
"That's symbolic, if you want to know my guess. Not literal." We started walking. "I think this killer is disgruntled, angry, feels a certain person in power, or perhaps people in power, are responsible for his problems in life."
"Like the Unabomber," I said as we took the elevator up.
"Very similar,"
perhaps even inspired by him, he said, glancing at his watch. Can I buy you a beer before you leave?
Not unless someone else is driving.
I smiled. But you can talk me into coffee. We walked through the gun cleaning room, where dozens of FBI and DEA agents were breaking down their weapons, wiping them and blasting parts with air. They glanced at us with curious eyes, and I wondered if they had heard the rumors. My relationship with Wesley had been an item of gossip for a long time at the academy, and it bothered me more than I let on. Most people, it seemed, maintained their belief that his wife had left because of me, when, in fact, she had left because of another man. Upstairs, the line was long in the PX, a mannequin modeling the latest sweatshirt and range pants, and Thanksgiving pumpkins and turkeys in the windows. Beyond, in the boardroom, the TV was loud, and some people were already into popcorn and beer. We sat as far away from everyone as we could, both of us sipping coffee. "What's your slant on the France connection?" I asked. "Obviously, this individual is intelligent and follows the news. Our relations with France were very strained during their nuclear weapons testing. You may recall the violence, vandalism, boycotting of French wine and other products. There was a lot of protesting outside French embassies, the U.S. very much involved."
"But that was a couple years ago."
"Doesn't matter. Wounds heal slowly." He stared out the window at darkness gathering. "And more to the point, France wouldn't appreciate our exporting a serial killer to them. I can only suppose that is what Dead Doc is implying. Cops from France and other nations have been worrying for years that our problem would eventually become theirs, as if violence is a disease that can spread."
"Which it is."
He nodded, reaching for his coffee again. "Maybe that would make more sense if we believe the same person killed 10 people here and in Ireland," I said. "Kay, we can't rule out anything." He sounded tired as he said that again. I shook my head. "He's taking credit for someone else's murders, and now threatening us. He probably has no idea how different his M.O. is from what we've seen in the past." "Of course, we can't rule out anything, Benton. But I know what my findings tell me, and I believe identifying this recent victim is going to be the key."
"You always believe that," he smiled, playing with his coffee stirrer.
"I know who I work for. Right this minute, I work for that poor woman whose torso is in my freezer." It was now completely dark out, the boardroom filling fast with healthy, clean-living men and women in color-coded fatigues. The noise was making it difficult to talk, and I needed to see Lucy before I left. "You don't like Ring." Wesley reached around to the back of his chair and collected his suit jacket. "He's bright and seems sincerely motivated."
"You definitely profiled the last part wrong," I said as I got up.
"But you are right about what you said first. I don't like him." "I thought that was rather obvious by your demeanor." We moved around people who were looking for chairs and setting down pitchers of beer. "I think he's dangerous."
"He's vain and wants to make a name for himself," Wesley said.
"And you don't think that's dangerous?" I looked over at him.
"It describes almost everyone I've ever worked with."
"Except for me, I hope."
"You, Dr. Scarpetta, are an exception to just about everything I can think of."
We were walking through a long corridor, heading to the lobby,
and I didn't want to leave him right now. I felt lonely and wasn't sure why. "I would love for us to have dinner," I said. "But Lucy's got something to show me."
"What makes you think I don't already have plans?"
He held the door for me. The thought bothered me, even though I knew he was teasing. "Let's wait until I can get away from here," he said. And we were walking toward the parking lot now. "Maybe over the weekend, when we can relax a little more. I'll cook this time. Where are you parked?"
"Over here."
I pointed the key's remote control. Doors unlocked, and the interior light went on. Typically, we didn't touch. We never had when someone might see. "Sometimes I hate this," I said as I got into my car. "It's fine to talk about body parts, rape and murder all day long, but not to hug each other, hold hands. God forbid anybody should see that." I started the engine. "Tell me how normal that is. It's not like we're still having an affair or committing a crime." I yanked my seatbelt across my chest. "Is there some don't ask, don't tell FBI rule no one's let me in on?"
"Yes."
He kissed me on the lips as a group of agents walked by. "So don't tell anyone," he said. Moments later, I parked in front of the Engineering Research Facility, or ERF, a huge space-age-looking building where the FBI conducted its classified technical research and development. If Lucy knew all of what went on in the labs here, she didn't tell. And there were few areas of the building where I was allowed, even when escorted by her. She was waiting by the front door as I pointed the remote control at my car, which wasn't responding. "It won't work here," she said. I looked up at the eerie rooftop of antennae and satellite dishes, sighing as I manually locked doors with the key. "You'd think I'd remember after all these times," I muttered. "Your investigator friend, Ring, tried to walk me over here after the consultation," she said, scanning her thumb in a biometric lock by the door. "He's not my friend," I told her. The lobby was high-ceilinged and arranged with glass cases displaying clunky, inefficient radio and electronic equipment used by law enforcement before ERF was built. "He asked me out again," she said. Corridors were monochromatic and seemed endless, and I was forever impressed with the silence and sense that no one was here. Scientists and engineers worked behind shut doors in spaces big enough to accommodate automobiles, helicopters, and small planes. Hundreds of bureau personnel were employed at ERF, yet they had virtually no contact with any of us across the street. We didn't know their names. "I'm sure there are a million people who would like to ask you out," I said, as we boarded an elevator and Lucy scanned her thumb again. "Usually not after they've been around me very long," she said. "I don't know. I haven't gotten rid of you yet." But she was very serious. "Once I start talking shop, the guys turn off. But he likes a challenge, if you know the type." "I know it all too well."
"He wants something from me, Aunt Kay."
"Would you like to hazard a guess? And where are you taking me, by the way?"
"I don't know, but I just have this feeling."
She opened a door to the virtual environment lab, adding, "I have a rather interesting idea." Lucy's ideas were always more than interesting. Usually they were frightening. I followed her into a room of virtual system processors and graphic computers stacked on top of each other,
and countertops scattered with tools, computer boards, chips, and peripherals like data gloves, and helmet-mounted displays. Electrical cords were bundled in thick hanks, and tied back from the blank expanse of linoleum flooring where Lucy routinely lost herself in cyberspace. She picked up a remote control, and two video displays blinked on, and I recognized the photographs Dead Doc had sent to me. They were big and in color on the screens, and I began to get nervous. "What are you doing?" I asked my niece. "The basic question has always been, does an immersion into an environment actually improve the operator's performance?" she said, typing computer commands. "You never got a chance to be immersed in this environment. The crime scene." Both of us stared at the bloody stumps and lined up body parts on the monitors, and a chill crept through me. "But suppose you could have that chance now," Lucy went on. "What if you could be inside Dead Doc's room?" I started to interrupt, but she wouldn't let me. "What else might you see? What else might you do?" she said. And when she got like this, she was almost manic. "What else might you learn about the victim and him?" "I don't know if I can use something like this," I protested. "Sure you can. Now what I haven't had time to do is add the synthetic sound. Well, except for the typical canned auditory cues. So a squelch is something opening. A click's a switch being turned on or off. A ding usually means you've just bumped into something." "Lucy," I said as she took my left arm, "what the hell are you talking about?" She carefully pulled a data glove over my left hand, making sure it was snug. "We use gestures for human communication, and we can use gestures, or positions as we call them, to communicate with the computer, too," she explained. The glove was black lycra, with fiber optic sensors mounted on the back of it. These were attached to a cable that led to the high-performance host computer that Lucy had been typing on. Next, she picked up a helmet-mounted display that was connected to another cable, and fear fluttered through my breast as she headed my way. "One VPL iPhone HRX," she cheerfully said. "Same thing they're using at NASA's Ames Research Center, which is where I discovered it." She was adjusting cables and straps. 350,000 color elements, superior resolution, and wide field of vision." She placed the helmet on top of my head, and it felt heavy and covered my eyes. "What you're looking into are liquid crystal displays, or LCDs, your basic video displays. Glass plates, electrodes, and molecules doing all kinds of cool things. How does it feel?" "Like I'm going to fall down and suffocate." I was beginning to panic, the way I had when I'd first learned how to scuba dive. "You're not going to do either." She was very patient, her hand steadying me. "Relax. It's normal to be phobic at first. I'll tell you what to do. Now you stand still and take deep breaths. I'm going to put you in." She made adjustments, tightening the display around my head, then returned to the host computer. I was blind and off balance, a tiny TV in front of each eye. "Okay, here we go," she said. "Don't know if it will do any good, but can't hurt to try." Keys clicked, and I was thrown inside that room. She began instructing me about what to do with my hand, to fly forward or faster, or in reverse, and how to release and grab.
I moved my index finger, made clicking motions, brought my thumb near my palm, and moved my arm across my chest as I broke out in a sweat. I spent a good 5 minutes on the ceiling and walking into walls. At one point, I was on top of the table where the torso lay on its bloody blue cover, stepping on evidence and the dead.
"I think I might throw up," I said.
"Just hold still for a minute," Lucy said. "Catch your breath."
I gestured as I started to say something more, and was instantly on the virtual floor, as if I had fallen from the air.
"That's why I told you to hold still," she said, as she watched what I was doing on the monitors. "Now, move your hand in and point with your first two fingers toward where you hear my voice coming from. Better?"
"Better," I said. I was standing on the floor in the room, as if the photograph had come to life, three-dimensional and large. I looked around and didn't actually see anything I hadn't before when Vander had done the image enhancement. It was what this made me feel, and what I felt changed what I saw. Walls were the color of putty, with faint discolorations that until now I had attributed to water damage, which might be expected in a basement or garage. But they seemed different now, more uniformly distributed, some so faint I could barely see them. Paper had once covered the putty paint on these walls. It had been removed, but not replaced, as had the cornice box or drapery rod. Above a window covered with shut Venetian blinds were small holes where brackets once had been. "This isn't where it happened," I said as my heart beat harder. Lucy was silent. "She was brought in here after the fact to be photographed. This isn't where the killing and dismemberment took place."
"What are you seeing?" she asked.
I moved my hand and walked closer to the virtual table. I pointed at the virtual walls to show Lucy what I saw.
"Where did he plug in the autopsy saw?" I said.
I could find but one electrical outlet, and it was at the base of a wall.
"And the drop cloth is from here, too?" I went on. "It doesn't fit with everything else. No paint, no tools."
I kept looking around.
"And look at the floor. The wood's lighter at the border, as if there once was a rug.
Who puts rugs in workshops?
Who has wallpaper and drapes?
Where are the outlets for power tools?"
"What do you feel?" she asked.
"I feel this is a room in someone's house where the furniture has been removed. Except there's some sort of table which has been covered with something. Maybe a shower curtain. I don't know. The room feels domestic." I reached out my hand and tried to touch the edge of the table cover, as if I could lift it and reveal what was underneath. And as I looked around, details became so clear to me, I wondered how I could have missed them before. Wiring was exposed in the ceiling directly above the table, as if a chandelier or other type of light fixture had once hung there.
"What about my color perception right now?" I asked. "Should be the same."
"Then there's something else. These walls," I touched them. "The color lightens in this direction. There's an opening. Maybe a doorway with light coming through it."
"There's no doorway in the photo," Lucy reminded me. "You can only see what's there."
It was odd, but for a moment, I thought I could smell her blood, the pungency of old flesh that has been dead for days. I remembered the doughy texture of her skin, and the peculiar eruptions that made me wonder if she had shingles. "She wasn't random," I said. "And the others were. The other cases are nothing like this one. I'm getting double imagery. Can you adjust that?" "Vertical retinal image disparity." Then I felt her hand on my arm. "Usually goes away after 15 or 20 minutes," she said. "It's time to take a break."
"I don't feel too good."
"Image rotation misalignment, visual fatigue, simulation sickness, cyber sick, whatever you want to call it," she said. "Causing image blurring, tears, even queasiness."
I couldn't wait to remove the helmet, and I was on the table again, face down in blood before I could get the LCDs away from my eyes. My hands were shaking as Lucy helped me take off the glove. I sat down on the floor.
"Are you all right?" she asked kindly.
"That was awful," I said.
"Then it was good."
She returned the helmet and glove to a counter.
"You were immersed in the environment. That's what should happen."
She handed me several tissues, and I wiped my face.
"What about the other photograph? Do you want to do that one, too?" she asked. "The one with the hands and feet?"
"I've been in that room quite enough," I said.
Chapter 8. I drove home haunted. I had been going to crime scenes most of my professional life, but had never had one come to me. The sensation of being inside that photograph, of imagining I could smell and feel what was left of that body, had shaken me badly. It was almost midnight by the time I pulled into my garage, and I couldn't unlock my door fast enough. Inside my house, I turned the alarm off, then back on the instant I shut and locked the door. I looked around to make sure nothing was out of place. Lighting a fire, I fixed a drink and missed cigarettes again. I turned on music to keep me company, then went inside my office to see what might await me there. I had various faxes and phone messages, and another communication and email. This time, all Dead Doc had for me was to repeat,
"You think you're so smart."
I was printing this and wondering if Squad 19 had seen it too, when the telephone rang, startling me.
"Hi," Wesley said. "Just making sure you got in okay."
"There's more mail," I said, and I told him what it was.
"Save it and go to bed."
It's hard not to think about.
He wants you to stay up all night thinking. That's his power. That's his game.
Why me?
I was out of sorts and still felt queasy.
"Because you're the challenge, Kay. Even for nice people like me.
Go to sleep. We'll talk tomorrow. I love you." But I didn't get to sleep long. At several minutes past 4 a.m., my phone rang again. It was Dr. Hoyt this time, a family practitioner in Norfolk, where he had served as a state-appointed medical examiner for the last 20 years. He was pushing 70, but spry and as lucid as new glass. I'd never known him to be alarmed by anything, and I was instantly unnerved by his tone.
"Dr. Scarpetta, I'm sorry," he said, and he was talking very fast. "I'm on Tanger Island."
All I could think of, oddly, were crab cakes.
"What in the world are you doing there?"
I arranged pillows behind me, reaching for call sheets and pen.
"I got called late yesterday. Been out here half the night.
The Coast Guard had to bring me in one of their cutters, and I don't like boats worth a damn, beaten and whipped around worse than eggs. Plus, it was cold as hell.
I had no idea what he was talking about.
The last time I saw anything like this was Texas, 1949. He went on, talking fast, when I was doing my residency and about to get married.
I had to cut him off.
"Slow down, Fred," I said. "Tell me what's happened."
A 52-year-old Tangier lady. Probably been dead at least 24 hours in her bedroom. She's got severe skin eruptions and crops, just covered with them, including the palms of her hands and the bottoms of her feet. Crazy as it sounds, it looks like smallpox.
"You're right. That's crazy," I said, as my mouth got dry.
"What about chickenpox?
Anyway, this woman was immunosuppressed?"
"I don't know anything about her, but I've never seen chickenpox look like this. These eruptions follow the smallpox pattern. They're in crops, like I said, all about the same age, and the farther away from the center of the body, the denser they get.
So they're confluent on the face, the extremities."
I was thinking of the torso, of the small area of eruptions that I had assumed were shingles.
My heart filled with dread.
I didn't know where that victim had died, but I believed it was somewhere in Virginia.
Tangier Island was also in Virginia, a tiny barrier island in the Chesapeake Bay, where the economy was based on crabbing.
"There are a lot of strange viruses out there these days," he was saying.
"Yes, there are," I agreed. "But Hanta, Ebola, HIV, dengue, et al. Don't cause the symptoms you've described.
That doesn't mean there isn't something else we don't know about."
"I know smallpox. I'm old enough to have seen it with my own two eyes. But I'm not an expert in infectious diseases, Kay. And I sure as hell don't know the things that you do. But whatever it might be in this case, the fact is the woman's dead, and some type of pox virus killed her."
"Obviously, she lived alone."
"Yes."
"And she was last seen alive when?"
"The chief's working on that."
"What chief?" I said.
"The Tangier Police Department has one officer. He's the chief. I'm in his trailer now using the phone."
"He's not overhearing this."
"No, no. He's out talking to neighbors. I did my best to get information without a whole lot of luck. You ever been out here?"
"No, I haven't."
"Let's just say they don't exactly rotate their crops. There are maybe three family names on the whole island. Most folks grow up here, never leave. It's mighty hard to understand a word they're saying. Now that's a dialect you won't hear in any other corner of the world."
"Nobody touches her until I have a better idea what we're dealing with," I said, unbuttoning my pajamas.
"What do you want me to do?"
he asked.
"Get the police chief to guard the house. No one goes in or near it until I say. Go home. I'll call you later in the day." The labs hadn't completed microbiology on the torso, and now I couldn't wait. I dressed in a hurry, fumbling with everything I touched, as if my motor skills had completely left me. I sped downtown on streets that were deserted, and at close to 5 was parking in my space behind the morgue. As I let myself into the bay, I startled the night security guard, and he startled me.
"Lord have mercy, Dr. Scarpetta," said Evans, who had watched over the building for as long as I had been here.
"Sorry," I said, my heart thudding. "I didn't mean to frighten you."
"Just making my rounds. Is everything all right?"
"I sure hope so." I went past him.
"Is something coming in?"
He followed me up the ramp. I opened the door leading inside and looked at him.
"Nothing I know of," I replied.
Now he was completely confused, for he didn't understand why I was here at this hour, if no case was coming in. He started shaking his head as he headed back toward the door leading out into the parking lot. From there, he would go next door to the lobby of the Consolidated Labs, where he would sit, watching a small flickering TV, until it was time to make his rounds again. Evans wouldn't step foot into the morgue. He didn't understand how anyone could, and I knew he was scared of me. "I won't be down here long," I told him. "Then I'll be upstairs."
"Yes, ma'am," he said, still shaking his head. "You know where I'll be."
Midway along the corridor in the autopsy suite was a room not often entered, and I stopped there first, unlocking the door. Inside were three freezers unlike any normally seen. They were stainless steel and oversized, with temperatures digitally displayed on doors. On each was a list of case numbers, indicating the unidentified people inside. I opened a door, and a thick fog rolled out as frigid air bit my face. She was in a pouch and on a tray, and I put on gown, gloves, face shield, every layer of protection we had. I knew I might already be in trouble, and the thought of Wingo and his vulnerable condition thrilled me with fear as I slid out the pouch and lifted it onto a stainless steel table in the middle of the room. Unzipping black vinyl, I exposed the torso to ambient air, and I went out and unlocked the autopsy suite. Collecting a scalpel and clean glass slides, I pulled the surgical mask back down over my nose and mouth and returned to the freezer room, shutting the door. The torso's outer layer of skin was moist as thawing began, and I used warm, wet towels to speed that along before unroofing vesicles, or the eruptions clustered over her hip and at the ragged margins of the amputations. With the scalpel, I scraped vesicular beds and made smears on the slides. I zipped up the pouch, marking it with blaze orange biological hazard tags, almost couldn't lift the body back up to its frigid shelf, my arms trembling under the strain. There was no one to call for help but Evans, so I managed on my own and placed more warnings on the door. I headed upstairs to the third floor and unlocked a small lab that would have looked like most were it not for various instruments used only in the microscopic study of tissue, or histology. On a counter was a tissue processor, which fixed and dehydrated samples such as liver, kidney, spleen, and then infiltrated them with paraffin. From there, the blocks went to the embedding center, and on to the microtome, where they were shaved into thin ribbons. The end product was what kept me bent over my microscope downstairs. While slides air-dried, I rooted around shelves, moving aside stains of bright orange, blue and pink in Copland jars, pulling out Graham's iodine for bacteria, oil red for fat in liver, silver nitrate, Bebrock scarlet, and acridine orange. As I thought about Tangier Island, where I'd never had a case before. Nor was there much crime, so I'd been told. Only drunkenness, which was common with men alone at sea. I thought of blue crab again, and irrationally wished Bev had sold me rockfish or tuna. Finding the bottle of Nicolaou Stain, I dipped in an eyedropper and carefully dripped a tiny amount of the red fluid on each slide, then finished with cover slips. These I secured in a sturdy cardboard folder, and I headed downstairs to my floor. By now, people were beginning to arrive for work, and they gave me odd looks as I came down the hall and boarded the elevator in scrubs, mask, and gloves. In my office, Rose was collecting dirty coffee mugs off my desk. She froze at the sight of me.
Dr. Scarpetta, she said. What in the world is going on?
I'm not sure, but I hope nothing, I replied as I sat at my desk and took the cover off my microscope.
She stood in the doorway, watching, as I placed a slide on the stage. She knew by my mood, if by nothing else, that something was very wrong.
What can I do to help? She said, in a grim, quiet way.
The smear on the slide came into focus, magnified 450 times, and then I applied a drop of oil. I stared at waves of bright red eosinophilic inclusions within infected epithelial cells, or the cytoplasmic Guarnieri bodies indicative of a pox-type virus. I fitted a Polaroid microcam to the microscope and took instant high-resolution color photographs of what I suspected would have cruelly killed the old woman anyway. Death had given her no humane choice, but had it been me, I would have chosen a gun or a blade.
Check MCV, see if Phyllis has gotten in, I said to Rose. Tell her the sample I sent on Saturday can't wait.
Within the hour, Rose had dropped me off at 11th and Marshall Streets, at the Medical College of Virginia, or MCV, where I had done my forensic pathology residency when I wasn't much older than the students I now advised and presented gross conferences to throughout the year. Sanger Hall was 60s architecture, with a facade of garish bright blue tiles that could be spotted for miles. I got on an elevator packed with other doctors I knew and students who feared them.
Good morning.
You too. Teaching a class?
I shook my head, surrounded by lab coats. I need to borrow your TEM.
You hear about the autopsy we had downstairs the other day? A pulmonary specialist said to me as doors parted. Mineral dust, pneumoconiosis. Borreliosis, specifically. How often you ever see that around here?
On the fifth floor, I walked quickly to the pathology electron microscopy lab, which housed the only transmission electron microscope, or TEM, in the city. Typically, carts and countertops hadn't an inch of room to spare, crowded with photo and light microscopes and other esoteric instruments for analyzing cell sizes and coating specimens with carbon for X-ray microanalysis. As a rule, TEM was reserved for the living, most often used in renal biopsies and specific tumors, and viruses rarely, and autopsy specimens almost never. In terms of my ongoing needs and patients already dead, it was difficult to get scientists and physicians very excited when hospital beds were filled with people awaiting word that might grant them a reprieve from a tragic end. So I never prodded microbiologist Dr. Phyllis Crowder into instant action on the occasions I had needed her in the past. She knew this was different. From the hall, I recognized her British accent as she talked on the phone.
I know. I understand that, she was saying as I knocked on the open door. But you're either going to have to reschedule or go on without me. Something else has come up. She smiled, motioning me in. I had known her during my residency days, and had always believed that kind words from faculty like her had everything to do with why I had come to mind when the chief's position had opened in Virginia. She was close to my age and had never married, her short hair the same dark gray as her eyes, and she always wore the same gold cross necklace that looked antique. Her parents were American, but she had been born in England, which was where she had trained and worked in her first lab. Bloody meetings, she complained as she got off the phone. There's nothing I hate more. People sitting around talking instead of doing.
She pulled gloves from a box and handed a pair to me. This was followed by a mask.
There's an extra lab coat on the back of the door, she added.
I followed her into the small dark room where she had been at work before the phone had rung. Slipping on the lab coat, I found a chair as she peered into a green phosphorescent screen inside the huge viewing chamber. The TEM looked more like an instrument for oceanography or astronomy than a normal microscope. The chamber always reminded me of the dive helmet of a dry suit, through which one could see eerie, ghostly images in an iridescent sea. Through a thick metal cylinder called the scope, running from the chamber to the ceiling, 100,000-volt beam was striking my specimen, which in this case was liver, that had been shaved to a thickness of 6 or 7 1/100ths of a micron. Smears, like the ones I had viewed with my light microscope, were simply too thick for the electron beam to pass through. Knowing this at autopsy, I had fixed liver and spleen sections in glutaraldehyde, which penetrated tissue very rapidly. These I had sent to Crowder, who I knew would eventually have them embedded in plastic and cut on the ultramicrotome, then the diamond knife, before being mounted on a tiny copper grid and stained with uranium and lead ions. What neither of us had expected was what we were looking at now, as we peered into the chamber at the green shadow of a specimen magnified almost 100,000 times. Knobs clicked as she adjusted intensity, contrast, and magnification. I looked at DNA double-stranded, brick-shaped virus particles, 200 to 250 nanometers in size. I stared without blinking at smallpox. "What do you think?" I said, hoping she would prove me wrong. "Without a doubt, it's some type of pox virus." She hedged her bets. "The question is, which one?" The fact that the eruptions didn't follow any nerve pattern, the fact that chickenpox is uncommon in someone this old, the fact that you may now have another case with these same manifestations causes me great concern. Other tests need to be done, but I treat this as a medical crisis. She looked at me. An international emergency. I'd call CDC. That's just what I'm going to do, I replied, swallowing hard. What sense do you make of this being associated with a dismembered body? She asked, making more adjustments as she peered into the chamber. I can make no sense of it, I said, getting up and feeling weak. Serial killers here, in Ireland, raping, chopping people up? I looked at her. She sighed. You ever wish you'd stayed with hospital pathology? The killers you deal with are just harder to see, I replied. The only way to get to Tangier Island was by water or air. Since there wasn't a huge tourist business there, ferries were few and didn't run after mid-October. Then one had to drive to Crisfield, Maryland, or in my case, go 85 miles to Reedville, where the Coast Guard was to pick me up. I left the office as most people were thinking about lunch. The afternoon was raw, the sky cloudy with a strong cold wind. I had left instructions for Rose to call the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in Atlanta, because every time I had tried, I was put on hold. She was also to reach Marino and Wesley, and let them know where I was going and that I would call as soon as I could.
I took 64 east to 360, and soon found myself in farmland. Fields were brown with fallow corn, hawks dipping and soaring in a part of the world where Baptist churches had names like Faith, Victory, and Zion. Trees wore kudzu like chainmail. And across the Rappahannock River, in the northern neck, homes were sprawling old manors that the present generation owner couldn't afford anymore. I passed more fields and crepe myrtles, and then the Northumberland Courthouse that had been built before the Civil War. In Heathsville were cemeteries with plastic flowers and cared-for plots, and an occasional painted anchor in a yard. I turned off through woods dense with pines, passing cornfields so close to the narrow road I could have reached out my window to touch brown stalks. At Buzzard's Point Marina, sailboats were moored and the red, white, and blue tour boat, Chesapeake Breeze, was going nowhere until spring. I had no trouble parking, and there was no one in the ticket booth to ask me for a dime. Waiting for me at the dock was a white Coast Guard boat. Guardsmen wore bright orange and blue anti-exposure coveralls, known as Mustang suits, and one of the men was climbing up on the pier. He was more senior than the others, with dark eyes and hair, and a 9mm Beretta on his hip. "Dr. Scarpetta," he carried his authority easily, but it was there. "Yes?" I said, and I had several bags, including a heavy hard case containing my microscope and microcam. "Let me help with those," he held out his hand. "I'm Ron Martinez, the station chief at Crisfield." "Thanks. I really appreciate this," I said.
"Hey, so do we."
The gap between the pier and the 40-foot patrol boat yawned and narrowed as the surge pushed the boat against the pier. Grabbing the rail, I boarded. Martinez went down a steep ladder, and I followed him into a hold packed with rescue equipment, fire hoses, and huge coils of rope, the air heavy with diesel fumes. He tucked my belongings in a secure spot and tied them down. Then he handed me a Mustang suit, life vest, and gloves.
"You're going to need to put these on, in case you go in. Not a pretty thought, but it can happen. The waters may be in the 50s.
His eyes lingered on me.
"You might want to stay down here," he added, as the boat